Don't turn it off now. You need this stuff. Tampa Bay's Tantalk Radio Network.
Ladies and gentlemen, coming up next, get ready to indulge your legal curiosity with a unique blend of knowledge and entertainment on Legal Candy with attorney Candace Colucci. Each week, she unwraps the sweet secrets of the legal world, covering a wide range of topics from property insurance claims and personal injury to national and Florida law hot topics. Guests will include industry whistleblowers, industry experts, and sweet surprises. Get ready for a flavorful journey through the legal landscape. And now, let's dive in with Candace.
Good afternoon, everyone. This is Legal Candy. Welcome to our show. Today's show is the final verdict from Trial of the Century to the Legacy of O.J. Simpson. And the reason why we are talking about him today is because O.J. Simpson has died. So he died on April 10th, 2024, and I think it really was almost like a reawakening of what had taken place, and it became this kind of retelling of the story of the trial of the century. What is your opinion if he was guilty or not? So just a little recap about O.J. Simpson. It was one of the most infamous trials in American history. It centered around the deaths of O.J. Simpson's ex-wife, Nicole Brown Simpson, and Ronald Goldman in June of 1994. Nicole and O.J.'s ex-wife, which is O.J.'s ex-wife, were found brutally murdered outside Nicole's Brentwood condo in Los Angeles. O.J. was a former NFL star, and then he had turned into an actor, and he became the prime suspect in the murders. The case gained significant media attention due to Simpson's celebrity status, and it became a massive high-profile trial. The prosecution ended up arguing that Simpson had committed the murders out of jealousy and rage, and while the defense claimed that he was innocent. The trial marked by dramatic courtroom moments, a nine-month trial, insane. And it ended with O.J. Simpson's acquittal in October 1995. So as we've talked about this before, I am an attorney with Colucci Law Group. I am a trial litigator, and I graduated from Stetson University School of Law, which is in Gulfport, Florida. And Stetson is the number one trial advocacy school in the country. They have been number one for like about 23, 24 years, something around that way. And that ranking comes from the fact that Stetson has a trial team, and we compete all over the world in order to gain that title. So it's just kind of like around kind of like having a football team for a school. And I was on that trial team, which is a very small amount of people, where once you make the team, it's usually there's only about 19 people who make the team. We spend, whenever you're not in school, we spend the entire time being trained by the best people in the world on trial litigation. So O.J. Simpson's trial is one of those things where you would be remiss to say that it didn't come with some of the best trial litigators that were defending O.J., not just because of his financial status, but definitely because of the high profile status. The case was huge, so it brought out the best of the best attorneys. And so through my training, some of the things that we've learned and are some of the strategies that were used during the O.J. Simpson trials are tried and true strategies that we have learned how to do and that I continue in my everyday practice. So just side note, we did have a trial last week, and we won that trial. And yay. I've taken all of those things I learned from trial litigation, from Stetson, and from some of the experts. F. Lee Bailey. Is one of the famous cross-examiners, and I studied his way of cross-examining in law school, and I use it until this day. And he was one of the attorneys for O.J. Simpson's dream team, is what they call it. So we are going today, we're going to kind of just take apart what happened during that trial of the century, so you guys can really understand what was the evidence that existed, And what happened during that trial that really just separated America? So stick with us and we will delve into it. So first let's talk about his death. So O.J. Simpson has died of cancer at 76 years old. And this is just one of those things where, like, once again, everyone was taking a side between people being, you know, sad that he was dead to where people were literally applauding the death. I mean, I saw a news article that was just like the day after that was pretty much like the headline was like, this morning, O.J. Simpson wakes up in a sauna box. And so and it's weird to remember he was found not guilty, right? Mm-hmm. But it didn't matter because in the world of public opinion, you had a massive amount of people who believed that he was guilty and a massive amount of people that believed like he was innocent. When the trial actually took place, I was in grade school, and I remember the verdict being told. We didn't even know what it meant for a verdict, but I just remember teachers talking about it. Like when they announced it, like they I think they may have even come on the public announcement. I think they may have made an announcement about it, but I just remember everyone talking, O.J. Simpson's innocent, O.J. Simpson's innocent, and it was huge controversy. And I think one of the biggest problems was that it turned so racial so fast, mm-hmm. right? At the very beginning, O.J. Simpson is, by all accounts, he was this famous athlete, and he was the number one draft pick in 1969. He was picked number one, so he was always considered the superstar. Then he paid for the Bills, and then he played for the San Francisco. So people really talked about O.J. Simpson being this, like, African-American idol. He has a Heisman Trophy winner. And so he was like the idol for the African-American community. And so once they started this narrative of, is this a just arrest or trial, or is this a racial attack? That's where I think people started really taking sides of, like, we believe it's just, I remember hearing these things, like, we believe this is just an attack of the black community to bring down a pillar of our society. And then you had other people going, had nothing to do with that. He's murdered these people who just happen to be white, and he's guilty of this crime. So the obituaries, we're talking about some of the obituaries that were out there, is that even that has sparked controversy of what is some of these news outlets saying. And so one of them was that you had the New York Times had originally phrased, his world was ruined after he was charged with killing his former wife and friend, which sparked reader outrage. And so then they actually changed the title to his trial for the murder of his former wife and her friend became an inflection point of race in America. So it's still this controversial topic that continues to kind of go forward. I like the one that Mary Catherine, we got Mary Catherine in the studio, MK, our content writer, who is so great with researching, looking through everyone. Say hi, MK.
Hello.
Hello. And so one of the things you were talking about was what did the LA Times do? They did an error where they...
The LA Times incorrectly confused O.J. Simpson with former President Donald Trump in its obituary.
What?
A mistake that was later corrected.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, my gosh. Okay, so they literally accidentally used Donald Trump's name. So I thought that was really interesting. And so we also did just find out, too, that in the last kind of days that O.J. Simpson was dying, he had all of his children, I guess, that came to see him. He's got four children, two that are from Nicole Simpson Brown. And that during his last moments, he had his children sign an NDA. So that is a non-disclosure agreement. None of us know exactly what was being said, but I guess everyone's probably, I guess at the very last moments of OJ's life, he still wants to make sure there's a nice level of controversy behind him, because now everybody wants to know what was said. What was possibly said during this time? Some of the legal issues about an NDA, we had a question already about an NDA. What does an NDA value if the person who is forcing the other people to sign or asking them to sign it ends up dying? So is it enforceable after death? And the answer is yes, it absolutely can be. Depending on the way that the NDA was crafted, and I would imagine with his access to lawyers, he probably had a good NDA. And so the NDA, at the end of the day, your rights as a human being, any rights that you had prior to your death, can actually exist after you dying through sometimes an estate, if he may have opened it before. And so the estate keeps those rights, so which means that if after his death someone violates the NDA, then the estate, either the executor of the estate, or let's say there's a trust or something like that, they now have the rights to go and sue whoever violated the NDA. So we don't really know what was said there, but we can only imagine. That was definitely an interesting little tidbit of information.
He also would not allow any mobile phones in there either,
because he didn't want anybody recording it.
All the phones were confiscated, yes. Even from his kids.
Just very, very interesting.
Yeah.
So we will go into our little legal disclaimer just so we know we're all on the same page. The content shared on Legal Candy is for informational purposes only and should not be taken as legal advice, does not create an attorney-client relationship. All information is gathered from public sources and may not be 100% factual. You absolutely can search the internet and look it up yourself. If you want any personalized legal advice, please reach out to the Colucci Law Group at 727-733-9438. If we can't help you, we will point you in the right direction of somebody that can. So let's get into the timeline of the murders of Nicole Simpson and Ron Goldman. So after attending her daughter's recital alongside her ex-husband, so O.J. Simpson, she goes to dinner with friends in Brentwood. And I have literally, I have been here, I have seen the property, I've driven by it. We stopped, we hung out there for a little while when I was in L.A. years ago. And so it is just eerie to kind of know all of that that took place in that area. They have since changed the address. That's an interesting thing, is that sometimes happens when there's something traumatic that happens at an address, you can petition the city. A lot of times the realtor, the property owner will be all about when they're before they're selling it, like, we've got to change the address because of what
it
stands for. No, the property's still there.
Really?
Yeah. Unless recently it was demolished. But I'll tell you, years ago, maybe 4 years ago was when I saw it last. It was just kind of surreal to be there and to know, you know, what all had taken place there. So the address has changed. So we've got Nicole Simpson, who goes to dinner, and that Goldman is working as a waiter at the restaurant she's at. Allegedly that Nicole leaves her sunglasses at the restaurant. She goes home, which is not very far away from where she's at. And then that is the reason why Ron Goldman is at her house. There's a bunch of controversy and questions about, were they in a relationship? Were they dating? I don't know why that would have been hidden. But since we didn't have all the text messages and emails and all of that stuff, you get a lot less of what people's motives are and what's happening in their life. Now you'll know. You would have known if you went through her phone, right? If she was dating him or not. But that was something that I remember being talked about, was were they in a relationship? So that's around 6:30 p.m. And then we've got around 10:41 p.m., Brian Cato Keelan, who is Simpson's house guest at his mansion just a couple of miles down the road from Nicole's home, hears a thumping noise on the outside of his wall and goes outside to investigate. We have 10:50 p.m. A neighbor spots Nicole Simpson's white dog barking with bloody paws. He's got bloody paws. Then 11:01 p.m., then you have the limousine driver from his name is Alan Park. He's there at Simpson's residence. He's waiting for Simpson's to come because Simpson is taking a flight to Chicago. So he says that he's waiting there since 10:25 p.m. That will become very important later on that timeline. But he says he knocked and nobody answered the door. So he just continues waiting because he ended up getting there early. But then around 11, that's when he sees, that's when he finally gets an answer from Simpson at the home. And then he actually leaves with Simpson and takes him to Chicago. About 12:10 a.m. is the dog leads neighbors to the dead bodies of Ron Goldman and Nicole Simpson, which lie near the gate in her residence. I'll tell you the way that it looks is they're actually little condominiums, but it's very much like a little maze. So if you walked up to the property right now and you looked at it, you can't really even see how many units there are because they're very, very coveted and hidden. Like she had her own, like pretty much like cement walls that kind of hid her in. Then there's a little mini gate to walk into the little condos. And then there's a gate, I think, in front of her home. And then you'd walk, after you go through the gate, you'd walk a little walkway. And then there's the front door. So if you're standing at her front door, you can't see what's going on unless you happen to walk in front of her little gate area. So her next door neighbors, even though it's a condo and you usually think, oh, everyone can see what's happening, it's built to where you can't see it. So if you're next door, if you're next door neighbor, you can't see at all what's going on in her residence, mm-hmm. unless you happen to walk right in front of her, in front of her door. So that's around 12:01. So the police get there and they see this bloody scene. It is horrific. You've got the beautiful Nicole Simpson, blonde hair, just gorgeous, and she has been just mutilated, stabbed several times. Her throat has been slashed, and it has been slashed down to, she's almost decapitated. And then also, Ron Goldman, he also has been stabbed, and his throat has been slashed. There is blood everywhere within, from the front door to kind of this walkway area that's, like I said, it's hidden. There's blood in several different spots. It's all over. They're covered with blood. And so right after the police start their investigation, you've got 4:15. Simpson checks into the hotel in Chicago. So he's already gone. He's on a plane. He's already now in Chicago. 4:30 a.m., the police arrive at Simpson's mansion to inform him that his ex-wife has died. And when they get there, that is where they discover the blood-stained Bronco, the famous Bronco that will become the center of all of this, of the beginning of this, I would say, at the beginning. And then they find a bloody glove. And that matches the one that they state that they found at the crime scene near Ron Goldman's body. So with that, we're going to take our first break of the day and stick with us because we will go through more of the timeline and tell you about why do we think that OJ walked away.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Get ready to elevate your nightlife experience at Club Prana. This five-story sensation in Ybor City is the talk of Tampa Bay. Each floor boasts a unique style and music format. They roll out the red carpet as their friendly staff pampers you with VIP treatment. Club Prana meets Tampa's nightlife standards with impeccable amenities. Live the luxe life every evening at Club Prana. For VIP reservations and bottle service, call or text 813-758-7755. Coastal Roofing, your trusted Florida roofing experts, puts you first. They excel in delivering exceptional roofing and general contracting services, proudly serving all counties. Their dedicated team guarantees not just your complete satisfaction, but an unforgettable experience. You also get a free inspection report and damage report. Rooted in integrity and powered by expertise, they consistently achieve the right results on schedule and within budget. For one contractor, great price, expert service, Coastal Roofing. 1-800-674-3675.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Okay, so when the police get to OJ's house, they are looking for, they really are going there for OJ, but they use it as an opportunity to potentially start doing some searching and looking around. One of the things that is interesting about the way the rules of evidence work is that when they get there and they see the Bronco, they start investigating the Bronco and they say that they see a blood, like a fingerprint that looks like a bloody fingerprint. Mm-hmm. So when people go, hey, where's your warrant? That's like some people think, cops can't search unless there's a warrant. Yeah. Unless there's certain called extenuating search circumstances. That allows an officer to now go forward and search when even though they don't have a search warrant. And one of the extenuating circumstances, which is very interesting, is if you believe as the officer that somebody is potentially hurt. So giving you an example, if I walk up to your door right now and I'm an officer and I don't have a warrant and I'm asking you questions and then all of a sudden from the back room I hear, help, 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 that now allows me to literally pass through you and go into the home, not to search everything, right, but to go and now investigate this potential harm. So we know we get that abused, that gets abused sometimes, but that is one of the first rules of evidence that ends up happening during this investigation, was that they use that one fingerprint, the bloody fingerprint, to go, maybe someone's hurt. Right. So we've got to get in here and figure it out. So that allows them to literally start opening the gates. They start climbing the gates, helping other officers in. And that's when they start walking around the residence. They end up, nobody answers the door. And so they do see that there is a side house, mother-in-law suite. And that is, there's somebody, in there. But on the way is where they find this bloody glove is technically what it is. And so they now figure out that around 10:45 a.m. they come back with a search warrant in hand. They've got enough. So they go to a judge and they get a search warrant to search Simpson's mansion, and they find more blood traces on the property. And after that, around 12 p.m., that is when OJ returns back to the mansion, and that is where he ends up being handcuffed and taken into police station for questioning. They have enough at that point. They've got blood. They've got a bloody glove that matches the glove they have on the scene. They feel like that gives them enough in order to take him into custody to now question him. And so this happens relatively fast at that point in time. June 16th is when, unfortunately, the funerals take place of Nicole Brown. OJ's there with his children, and Ron Goldman also has his funeral. So then when we get to the Bronco chase, is that what happens there is that a lot of times, sometimes when you've got, when you lawyer up, so he lawyers up. I think the first lawyer he gets is Robert Shapiro. That becomes his attorney. And he starts off with Howard Weitzman, and then Robert Shapiro takes over. And as you know, he ends up also, I think, we find out later on through the Kardashian world, right? So through listening and talking to the Kardashians and tell their story, is that they state, and Robert Kardashian, which is their father, who is also part of his legal team, Robert Kardashian, I think, was more of a friend to OJ and more of a general attorney to him, counsel. He's not necessarily a trial litigator. He does join this team, but allegedly he does go to Robert Kardashian's house, and there, and we find out later on that there's, that some of the children remember when he was there, and that there was some argument that they've heard, that OJ was very scared about what was taking place. And so based on that, the police department has all they need, I feel, in order to charge him. So they've charged him with the two counts of first-degree murder for the deaths of Nicole and Ron. And so OJ is supposed to turn himself in, and that is sometimes does take place. Sometimes you can, if you've lawyered up, your lawyer will kind of be in touch with the police department, and they may say, hey, listen, we're going to now put a warrant out, and can you please turn yourself in? So it's not this big show. So they were trying to avoid this big show by literally saying, you're going to turn yourself in, which he was supposed to do. And we know he does the opposite of turn himself in, does the complete opposite. He gets in his white Bronco and starts to drive the freeway. And during this drive, it was a 60-mile drive. There's helicopters. How many people are watching this now on TV?
95 million.
95 live. Million people are watching this live chase of O.J. Simpson. They know that his wife has been murdered. They're not really sure of all the evidence that exists. What they do know now is that the prime suspect is now on the run. And this kind of starts, I think, the division between what side you end up being on, is that while he's on this chase, it becomes so publicized that people start pulling over. They have handmade signs with like cardboard and marker writing that are like, save the juice, we love juice. Yeah. And that's because that was one of his nicknames, OJ the Juice, because he, I guess he was, I don't even know exactly how he got it, but I know that he was amazing running back. And so... Honestly. So you've got people who are cheering him on during this chase. And so he finally surrenders at his house a little before 9 p.m. and he's arrested and jailed at that time without bond. So in July of 2022, 1994, O.J. Simpson pleads not guilty to this crime, and the penalty that the prosecutors start to seek is life without parole. So they start now putting together this case, and they actually put the case together pretty quickly, I would say. I mean, sometimes it takes years for these cases to go to trial, and it doesn't take that long for it to go trial, but it ends up being an insanely long trial. This is not a normal criminal defense trial. It is abnormally long with how far it goes. So when we talk about his dream team of attorneys, at that point in time, O.J. Simpson he's been retired from football. I don't know what his net worth was at that point in time, but he gets this team that it's not just based on who he was and how much money he may have had. It really comes down to majority of it of how big of a profile every attorney knew. Every attorney who's potentially going to join this team knows that they are going to go down in history. That was a given. That they were going to automatically become an expert in the area. They could write books. They could be done movies, documentaries, everything. So that always brings out great attorneys, and also attorneys that are willing to work for almost little to nothing because they know the publicity they're going to get afterwards is well worth their time to put into this case. Same thing with like Casey Anthony. Casey Anthony never paid for her attorney. He came forward knowing how big this case was that he was like, I'll do it for free. I think later on they fought about what free really meant, that maybe she gave up some sexual favors. I remember hearing some of that allegedly. But he was willing to come forward because of the publicity behind it, which did not disappoint. This publicity became massive for every attorney involved. It changed their life. For the defense, it changed it in a way that was very, very remarkable and lucrative for them. And for the prosecution, it wasn't all the same because of what happens during the trial. So the trial starts June 24th, 1995, and they end up choosing a jury of, so we got 12 people on that jury, because we're talking about first degree murder. And so the jury ends up consisting of, and this is always interesting, because remember, I always say jury selection is so important. It is so important during that jury selection that their attorneys are asking questions of the potential jury members in order to pick the jury that you believe is going to match potentially what you're trying to show them afterwards during the trial. So the final of the jury, the people on the jury are, okay, so it ends up being 8 African-Americans, mm-hmm. 8 African-Americans, 2 Hispanics, 1 half Caucasian, and the other one's half Native American. And then there's 1 Caucasian female. So you're talking about, I mean, I think just the situation like that, and let me tell you, one day we'll go into how complicated jury selection is. There is an element of jury selection where the attorneys are participating, asking questions, deciding who they want to strike. They only usually get to each strike so many people. But it really comes down to fate. Fate is the way that when the jury sets up, I get so many strikes, they get so many strikes, and depending on who's sitting where will kind of be a huge determination of who ends up on the jury. So it really is fate. So the fact that it ends up with 8 black people on this jury ends up playing a huge role in the defense that O.J. Simpson puts up, because they're biggest defense and their strategy really centered around racism. Huge with racism and the fact that they believe that this was a mishandling of justice, that the police department didn't do their responsibilities with collecting evidence and those kind of things. So the jury gets selected and they start the trial of the century. It is televised and everyone watches. I think the world stopped. I mean, and it really went on for days. So I can imagine, I was too young at the time to really tell you what took place day to day, but I know everybody remembers what was all taking place, getting updates at the end of the day of like what had happened that day, and everybody's talking about it by the water cooler and taking those positions. And it was very dividing racially dividing. And no one really even knew what all the evidence was, because you get some of it out on in public opinion, but not everything ended up coming out until really the trial. And during the trial, not even everything ended up coming out. But you have people who were taking sides, and this really became kind of a race division when it really came down a lot to the evidence and the, unfortunately, some of the missteps of the police department. So let's get into some of the key evidence that took place. So the prosecution goes first. So the prosecution puts on their case. By no stretch of the imagination, the prosecution thought this was a slam dunk. They were just like, I mean, if you look back now, there's so many documentaries about it. There's so much stuff that takes place afterwards of people talking about this trial from every police officer that was involved with it. A lot of them have done stories and interviews. We've been able to analyze what some of the jury members who are willing to come forward and say. But pretty much you've got the state attorneys, the prosecution, going, they believe that they have, some of them are saying, I don't know if I've seen a case with better evidence besides somebody admitting or there being a camera showing what they've done. That they were that secure with this much evidence. And then you have attorneys, state attorneys, and you have police officers who also will say that there are people serving life in jail who've been given the death penalty with less evidence. The question is why? Why? How can that happen? And it's because trials are not always about, and let's see, you have that quote, Mary Catherine, that you were talking about the quote at the very end where you were saying like that really it comes down to the presentation of evidence and not so much like public opinion.
The Dershowitz quote, yeah. In the American justice system, guilt is not determined by the subjective morality of the public, but by the objective presentation of evidence and the establishment of proof beyond a reasonable doubt.
Yes. By Alan Dershowitz. Yes. So that means it's not always if someone's innocent or guilty or what the public opinion thinks. It really comes down to the evidence that gets presented during trial. During trial. And we've talked about there are rules of trial that allow certain evidence in and certain evidence out. There are times when there is an admission by somebody. Someone admits to a crime, admits to the officer exactly what they did. They go into complete detail. But because of the rules of evidence, their attorney may be able to get that admission completely thrown out for certain reasons, and then it goes to trial and that admission never comes in and they may walk free. It has happened. It happens. So really it comes down to the evidence that comes into trial and what case ends up being presented. And so the state attorney is like, you know, we've got this in the bag. This is going to be an easy, open, shut case. We have so much evidence from the blood trail. So let's go over some of the evidence that the state really relies upon. So we've got DNA evidence. The prosecution really shows extensive amount of DNA evidence linking OJ to the crime scene. So we have blood allegedly matching OJ's that is found in his car, that also matches some of the blood that is at the crime scene. And then we also have, there's trails of blood that they said that really kind of go from her residence pretty much all the way to the mansion using that Bronco. So they believe the Bronco is what was driven. So there's DNA evidence that matches Nicole Simpson that is in the Bronco. There's DNA evidence that allegedly matches Nicole Simpson that ends up in OJ Simpson's home. And so they really feel like they've got a lot there. They find that there's DNA evidence at the scene of the crime, and they had already kind of analyzed when they found that DNA evidence that they believed that whoever it is who committed this crime doing the stabbing had injured themselves and their blood was on the scene. And that's so when they did the test and they matched it to OJ Simpson's, they were just like, yeah, here's another piece of evidence too. And that's very common with crime of passion or a over stabbing. A lot of times whoever's doing the murder will end up stabbing, will end up having nick marks on their hands just from slipping of the knife. Now it sounds crazy, but a lot of blood becomes slippery. So while they're stabbing over and over and over again, a lot of times the knife slips and they'll get a cut in their hand. And so they, when they find OJ, he has a cut also on his hand. Mm-hmm. And I guess his story changes about where this cut comes from. He first says he got it in Chicago. And then he goes, no, actually, I got it in LA, because he realized that his DNA was actually at the Bronco while he was gone. So then he goes, well, I really cut it then, and then it reopened in Chicago. So nothing really is consistent. And so they've got all this DNA that they believe is connecting Simpson to this crime scene. So we're going to go on our second break of the day. So stick with us and we'll continue to rip apart the yummy pieces of this evidence.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Coastal Roofing, your trusted Florida roofing experts, puts you first. They excel in delivering exceptional roofing and general contracting services, proudly serving all counties. Their dedicated team guarantees not just your complete satisfaction, but an unforgettable experience. You also get a free inspection report and damage report. Rooted in integrity and powered by expertise, they consistently achieve the right results on schedule and within budget. For one contractor, great price, expert service, Coastal Roofing. 1-800-674-3675. Get ready to elevate your nightlife experience at Club Prana. This five-story sensation in Ybor City is the talk of Tampa Bay. Each floor boasts a unique style and music format. They roll out the red carpet as their friendly staff pampers you with VIP treatment. Club Prana meets Tampa's nightlife standards with impeccable amenities. Live the luxe life every evening at Club Prana. For VIP reservations and bottle service, call or text 813-758-7755.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
And MK just informed me, side note, that OJ was called the Juice because, tell us why?
OJ stands for orange juice, and when he was an offensive lineman for the Bills, he was known as, orange juice is a form of electricity, and he was the electric company. He was nicknamed the electric company. So the juice.
That's where juice comes from.
That's where it comes
from. The juice.
From.
Okay. Now we know. So back to the evidence, the best evidence that the state had is that they've got all this DNA evidence that they end up linking back. And then they also additionally have the physical evidence would be the bloody glove. So at the crime scene, they find one bloody glove, and then allegedly at Simpson's mansion, while the police officers are searching around the area, they find another bloody glove. Also, this is always one of my favorite facts, was the shoe print. Mm-hmm. So at the crime scene, there is several bloody shoe prints of a Bruno Magli shoe, which is a luxury Italian shoe, and it is size 12. And so that is not a very common shoe. I mean, in the area, because it is, you're talking about LA, Brentwood area, it's much more common there. But the size 12 is probably one of the most uncommon parts of it, is we're talking about that is a nice size shoe. And it also matched OJ Simpson's shoe. And this little piece of evidence just talks about how when an investigation starts, how far back they can go sometimes, is that they were never able to actually find the Bruno shoe that OJ owned it. I think there ended up being a photo of him maybe wearing the shoe, but there ends up being an interview with a Bloomingdale's salesperson that they state that in the 1990s, the early 1990s, that OJ Simpson had come in and had tried on that shoe. So interesting how it all kind of connects back together. So you've got a shoe that probably is something that he may have worn in a size that definitely fits him. The timeline of everything that takes place, they believe, the state attorney's office believes that it all lines up, that he had enough time to murder Nicole Simpson and Ron Goldman, and make it back to the house because he wasn't really available. He wasn't answering the door right when the limo driver was there, but he then eventually answers the door. So that was enough time for him to kind of get there and get everything situated and then leave. Then the motive and history of domestic violence, this was really heartbreaking, was they even play it during the trial, is that there is a long line of history of domestic abuse that OJ had done towards Nicole Simpson. And so they played 911 calls of, you can hear Nicole's voice. It's almost like a voice from the grave. You can hear her voice during the trial where she is pleading towards the police department to come. She says, you know, it's OJ and you know his story. I mean, you know his background. And he is banging on the door. He already broke into my house. He's hurt me. I'm afraid, you know. And so that was something that was compelling, too, when we're talking about potential motive there, that there obviously is a contentious relationship. They were no longer together. They'd only divorced, I think, 2 years prior. And so that was part of their motive. And the fact that they even were able to show that he had been in her house, broken into her house, had committed abuse to her. She had family members who testified to the extent of that the abuse. There were photos the police department had of prior incidents of physical abuse where her face was all bruised up. And there was fiber evidence. So they also had found fibers in the Bronco. And they said that the fibers from the clothing matched Nicole Simpson. And then we have the attempt to flee. That was huge, too. That I tell people all the time, you know, if you try to flee, that is always used heavily by a jury a lot of times, that you would only run if you were guilty. And during his running, he also leaves a note and is saying things like, I hope they remember me for something better than this. I want to be with Nicole. Like, very much it seeming like, I don't know if you're innocent, if that's really what you would be doing. And at that point, he had just been charged and even know all, I don't think he even knew all the full evidence that was against him.
His note said, I've had a great life, great friends, and please think of the real OJ and not this lost person.
Jeez. So that's what he says while he's attempting to run and not turn himself in. So that was a huge piece of evidence that they were using. They brought experts after expert after expert. This trial, in my opinion, as a trial litigator, became the trial of the experts. And that happens a lot, where they had an expert saying one thing while there was another expert saying the opposite things because they could afford to have the experts. They were all coming forward in this famous trial where they were willing to come forward for free because of how big it was. So it became down to this nitty-gritty of these experts and calling into question the state's witnesses. And at the time, I think that the state would have thought that some of their good witness, their good evidence would have been how they had handled the crime scene, how they were documenting the evidence. They did a bunch of recording, so there's video at that time where they were really videotaping them collecting all this evidence. And I think they felt secure at the time that, look, we've got all this, we've preserved it all, that this is really an airtight case. And they slowly find out that is not the case at all. So when a defense starts their case, what the idea, so the prosecution goes, state attorneys go, that's who they are, and you can call them state attorneys or prosecutors. They put on all of this case and all of their witnesses testify. They've got their experts out there. And at the same time, the defense gets to now cross-examine them and call into question the credibility of each person who's testifying. It's the credibility of the person saying it or the credibility of the investigation. And O.J. Simpson's defense was not just about the racism, but it's also going to be a lot about the fact that they believe that you cannot rely on this evidence because it wasn't collected correctly. It wasn't preserved correctly. And those are legitimate things to call into question. And I don't think, I for the life of me, now that you're hearing it, you've heard it afterwards so many times, no matter how prepared an attorney is for trial, I don't think that they were fully prepared for the extent of really the impeachment is what we call it. So impeaching someone is to really call out their credibility in a way that you have evidence that contradicts that. So the defense did a really good job of calling into question things like how they collected the evidence. Right. So that was one of the main things, is like they had a big witness. The state attorneys had a big witness on who's talking about that. Oh, they collected it right. And he asked a question. I think the question was, did you use gloves to collect this evidence? Which gloves need to be worn at all times. There is a high level of contamination that can happen in collecting of the evidence. And so those are some of the questions, where did you wear gloves? And this expert on the stand for the state attorney's office said, yeah, I wore gloves. And right there, they impeached him because they had video evidence that showed that he didn't wear gloves the whole time. And so this was really the idea of the defense, was to really continue to question the credibility of the way that they collected the evidence, where they put it. One of the things is they said that, listen, you guys took this evidence and put it into a plastic bag and you put it into a van that wasn't turned on, that sat there in heat for hours. And so they continuously had their own experts who were saying that can contaminate it, that can make it to where it's not reliable. But I did like, there was one police officer who was in an interview that I watched, who literally was just, you can tell how appalled some of these people were that it didn't come back with the guilty verdict, is he said, listen, even if we didn't collect it correctly, we have test results that show that this DNA is O.J. Simpson's DNA. It was like, the only way it couldn't be is like one in, I'm trying to even think about what the number was. It was something remarkable, to where it was like, is there any way that it could not be O.J.'s blood? And it's one in a billion that it could be somebody else's.
But is that reasonable doubt?
So we'll talk about reasonable doubt, which is, that's the burden that they have to show. No, I would not say reasonable doubt, and we'll talk about it because we're running out of time today. We're going to talk about it next week. Is, you take every doubt that are reasonable, and the state's burden is to overcome each of those doubts. But they have to be reasonable. And that is always where sometimes a jury gets a little bit confused about how that burden works. It's not every crazy doubt. If I tell you right now, what are the odds that this blood is not O.J. Simpson's? And I said to you it was one in a billion, that's not reasonable. It's not reasonable for you not to believe that that is O.J.'s blood. Now, if you don't understand how the burden works, you may listen to that and go, well, that's a doubt, and they didn't overcome it. It's one in a billion. But the word in front of doubt is reasonable. That is what the jury is instructed in criminal cases. That's what the law is that it's beyond all reasonable doubt, not just every doubt. And that's usually the most confusing part, is that our jury will go, and this will be an example, is that maybe the defense goes, oh, well, and I almost wanted to say, oh, maybe it's aliens. Now we know. Right. Now we know, right, by evidence that that's probably possible. But let's just say it was something more outlandish of, oh, maybe it's because time started moving backwards. Well, that could be a doubt, but it's not reasonable. You can't reasonably believe that time started moving backwards. So you're not supposed to take into account that doubt. If that's your doubt, you should erase it, and you should still go forward with finding the person guilty of this crime. So that is usually where one of those issues really kind of come into the jury understanding reasonable doubt. And that may have been a huge area here of really understanding what a reasonable doubt was. So the defense really rips apart the way the evidence was collected, how it was preserved, and where they got the evidence from. So one of the pieces that I thought that was interesting is that some of the most important evidence about this blood was that they found a bloody fingerprint that was at the gate of Nicole Simpson's home. So there's a bloody fingerprint near the gate. And then they also find a bloody sock at Simpson's residence that is allegedly Nicole Simpson's sock, and the bloody fingerprint at the gate is allegedly O.J. Simpson's. Mm-hmm. So those two were really important kind of pieces of evidence that really kind of ties it back together. If his socks at his home have Nicole's blood on it, then it's really likely that we can all tie this back to him. But when they ripped apart that, those pieces of evidence, they realized that there was something inside of the evidence, so inside the actual blood. And it is called EDTA, was in the blood that's at the gate and the socks. And it's a chemical to preserve the blood in the lab, okay? They also found that fingerprint on the gate 3 weeks later. So 3 weeks later, when they're going back to the crime scene, the police department finds this fingerprint. So those are some of the things that start weighing on the jury to think, do they believe the defense's defense, which is not just that this was racism and bad policing, but also that we believe that because of their racial discrimination, that there is evidence that was potentially planted them, mm-hmm. that they believe that Mr. Mark Furman becomes huge. He becomes the star at this point at the end of the day, not really knowing that. He ends up being the police officer who is kind of first to arrive on the actual crime scene. And he also is one of the first officers to go to Simpson's actual resident. So part of the defense was that this man had a racial bias against black people, and that he was going to do anything to make sure that OJ had not gotten away with this. And so they believed that the fingerprint was potentially placed there. And so based on that, as they said, they found that chemical in there, and that chemical only would have been in there from the blood that had already been taken from OJ, that had been brought back to the lab, that had this chemical in it, and now that's the blood that magically appears 3 weeks later. The same thing with the sock. They had an expert who ripped apart the sock evidence. The state attorneys are saying that the sock evidence shows that there's that Nicole's blood is splattered on the sock. So their theory was that OJ Simpson had these shoes on with the sock, and that as he's murdering Nicole, the blood spatters onto his sock. And they have an expert who rips it apart, who says, actually, no, that's not what took place, because had he been wearing the sock when the blood came on there, the blood would have actually gone into the little particles, and it wasn't in the particles of the sock. It actually had been wiped on the outside and had that chemical in it. So they believed that was placed there. So we are all out of time for today. Stick with us and come listen to us next week as we give you some more little sweet nuggets of what took place in the O.J. Simpson's trial to really show how inevitably, they ended their closing argument with, if it doesn't fit, you must acquit. And they found him not guilty after all of that evidence.
Ladies and gentlemen, that wraps up another delicious episode of Legal Candy with attorney Candace Colucci. We hope you've enjoyed our legal confections and insightful discussions. Don't forget to mark your calendars, because we'll be back next week at 2 p.m. with more sweet surprises and special guests. Keep those legal questions coming. Until then, take care, stay curious, and see you next week for another flavorful journey through the legal landscape.